This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today, comedian Louis C.K., has a new stand-up special called Chewed Up. It premiered last weekend on the Showtime Cable Network and will be released in December in both CD and DVD formats. Here's a quick taste.
Kids are like buckets of disease that live in your house, and you get sick from them all the time. I got sick last week. I had a flu that I caught because my daughter coughed into my mouth. Just hit me right in the back of the throat. I'm like, thanks, honey. I'm sick right now. I can feel it already. She did this, by the way, because she's trying to tell me a secret. And she thinks you tell secrets into people's mouths. She takes her whole face. Which is inconsiderate, borderline retarded behavior, if you ask me. And by the way, she's five. 5 years old. What secret does she have that I really need to hear? Like, she's going to tell me a secret, and I'm going to go, holy shit, are you serious? Oh, my God. Honey, I won't tell anybody. That is up, though. Seriously? She got an abortion on Christmas Eve? Oh, my God.
Louis C.K. from his new stand-up comedy special, Chewed Up. Before going solo as a comic, Louis C.K. wrote for Late Night with Conan O'Brien, Late Show with David Letterman, and The Chris Rock Show. He then starred in his own sitcom, HBO's short-lived Lucky Louie. He's currently on a national tour of an all-new comedy act called Louis C.K. Hilarious. And next year, he'll appear in the movie This Side of the Truth, along with Ricky Gervais and Jennifer Garner. Terry spoke to Louis C.K. in 2006 and asked him about his early work writing for other comics.
How did you end up in comedy? Your first career, I think, was working as a mechanic.
It wasn't really a career. I did it while I was doing comedy at night. I would go work in garages fixing mufflers and brakes and stuff. And I loved fixing cars. I actually did think at one point that that's what I wanted to do because I was able to do it. But I just loved stand-up my whole life, and I grew up in Boston, and I heard something on the radio about open mic night at a comedy club that anyone that wanted to could go in and try it. And as soon as I knew that existed, I went and tried it. And I was very bad and unfunny, and I bombed. And I tried it again, and I was bad again. But I just kept at it, and it was an obsession with me. And when I was in junior high school, I did a lot of drugs. And I got in a lot of trouble. So I think that when I started doing that stuff, my mother was unbelievably supportive. I lived at home at some ages that I shouldn't have. I would leave and then come back. And she was always very helpful because I just wasn't any longer a criminal drug addict. She was so happy that I was doing anything legal.
Eventually, David Letterman hired you to be a writer on his show. And this was after you were a guest on his show. Did you so impress him as a guest that he hired you as a writer?
No, it was kind of the other way around because I had written on Conan. I was there from the beginning of the show. Me and a bunch of guys got hired as writers before it was on the air. So I got to launch that show with the first writing staff, which was a singularly great experience. And after I was gone from there, I'd been there for 2 years and I left, and then the Letterman show kind of heard that I was sort of one of the good writers on Conan, so they wanted to snap me up and they offered me a writing job, and I said, you gotta let me be a stand-up on the show first, because that was my dream, to do stand-up on Letterman. So they let me do stand-up on the show first, and the following week I was hired as a writer.
Well, let's talk about being one of the first writers on Conan O'Brien's show and launching the show. You know, just to refresh everybody's memory, when Conan O'Brien's show started, everybody thought he would fail. Like, who is this guy, and why was he chosen to get this prestigious late night spot that everybody wanted? So what were some of the things that you tried to think of as a writer to help establish, like, who he was and what the show's identity was?
It's funny. We didn't really think that way. We just were. We were very young. I mean, everybody was young. When I met Conan, he was 30, which amazes me now. And Robert Smigel, who was the head of that show, was 29, and I was 25, I guess. And the writers ran the range between those ages. But anyway, we just were trying to be really funny. And Conan, what I really admire him more about than anything was how much courage he had then, because he really was an unpracticed, uncertain performer. But he tried bits that I've seen really veteran comedian and broadcasters walk away from because they're just too risky and too strange. But he'd go, sure, I'll try that. for all of his greenness, he was like, yeah, I'll try that completely ridiculous bit that will probably bomb. And he would stand there and sell it. Last night on Conan O'Brien, and then we'd show these really lush action sequences that would make it look like Conan's show was like Dallas with cliffhangers at the end of every show. And we had like cars going off cliffs that we borrowed footage from stock footage companies. But yeah, him and they would be having fist fights and, you know, women dressed in, gowns, yelling at each other and stuff. That stuff was actually pretty easy to laugh at and pretty fun. But then I'd hang Conan out to dry on other stuff what's a good example? I remember it's kind of a important thing for a writer to go through to watch somebody bomb with your material and feel the empathy for them and realize the positions you put them in. We did a thing on Conan that I created called Actual Items, where we do the thing where you show small town news and you're amazed at how silly the items are, and you say how they're real, but we would make ours up so they'd be ridiculous, you know? We had one that I wrote that was for coins. Sometimes in, like, TV Guide, you see old coins for sale that you can mail away for. Mm-hmm. And the thing said, these coins are so old that you could buy slaves with them. And, I mean, an awfully offensive joke. And he didn't really want to do it. But I said, come on, don't be a baby. And he did it, and it got roundly booed. And he sat there with a big smile on his face, and he just took that boo. And I was sitting safely by the doors. Nobody was bothering me. I learned at that moment, like, it's just not fair to make other people bomb with your stuff as cute as you think it is.
Now, you used to write for the Chris Rock show, his HBO mm-hmm. variety kind of show. And I think people are probably very surprised to hear that because so much of Chris Rock's humor is about being black and you're not black. So mm-hmm. did you end up writing sketches that are or writing monologues that are about being black? And if so, what's that like?
Well, it's funny. When I started writing at Chris Rock, I think a lot of us, the white writers, were conscious of it. And at one point, Chris said, stop thinking of this as a black show. This is not a black show. Just write the weird stuff you did at Conan and write it here. Like, we had a fake PSA, like those Latter-day Saints PSAs. A black guy and a white guy see each other on a dark street, and they're both scared, and you hear their interior monologue, you know, what is he doing in my neighborhood? You know, is he going to rob me? Yeah, those were always funny to me, too, because, like, the black guy's worried the white guy's going to rob him. You know, come on. Not really. So the black guy and the white guy meet on the street, and they're both kind of scared. And they say, what do you want? You want something? Maybe I do want something. And then all of a sudden they start making out, like just kissing, really. And we got this interracial gay couple to shoot this with us. And then the voiceover says, gay sex brings men together of all races. And that it's like, you know, gay sex, the whatever. And it was brought to you by the Church of Latter-day Gay Sex. That was HBO. You could do that. Anyway, that got about 4 minutes of sustained laughter and screaming from his audience. That was one of my favorite moments of my life, probably, was when we first showed that to Chris's audience. And they just went berserk. It was great.
Our guest today is comedian Louis C.K., who's currently on tour with a new stand-up routine. Here's another piece from his stand-up act, Louis C.K. Chewed Up, which premiered on Showtime last week.
So I'm driving to Walgreens, it was nighttime, and I'm driving, and then I see a deer, and I hate deer. I hate them, because they're everywhere up there. I used to live in the city, and I loved deer then, because I was this liberal in the city, and I'd see deer, and, you know, you're driving with your friends out to the country, and you see a deer, and everybody's like, oh my God, turn off the car, don't scare the deer. It's just so beautiful, look at the beautiful deer. Look how he looks around, it's just so mysterious and beautiful. God gave us a gift, everybody, just enjoy it, just enjoy the gift of the beautiful deer. But now I live, and deer are in my yard every day, and they suck. They're just rats with hooves. They don't matter. They have ticks that give you Lyme disease, and they everywhere. And they make a noise. Did you know that? They go, oh. I go out every morning and throw rocks at them, and I try really hard to hit them on the head with rocks.
Terry spoke with Louis C.K. in 2006 when his HBO series Lucky Louie was on the air.
What were some of the sitcoms that you grew up with, the ones that you particularly liked and the ones that you particularly did not?
I always liked All in the Family. I loved. And I always loved The Honeymooners when I would see it in reruns and stuff. Even more so later in life, The Honeymooners. But I just thought All in the Family was such an awesome show. And I also liked Good Times. And also Barney Miller, which doesn't have much relation to this show, except for that the people on Barney Miller are very ordinary. You would never see a guy like Jack Sue being the star of a sitcom today, or the dude that played Wojciechowicz. You know, those were just average Americans. And so there was a lot I loved about that show, too. I didn't like shows like, and this is just personal, subjective. I don't judge these shows. They just didn't hit with me. Shows like Cheers when I started getting older, and Frasier in those shows, and Friends. I just don't connect with those shows. They're very slick, and they're very perfect, and the people are pretty, and they're shot very nicely, and they stopped feeling like these raw theatrical productions that I grew up watching, these Norman Lear shows where people are just dropping wild, wild statements in front of an audience, and that you just feel the kinetic energy of this kind of honesty. That's what I thought at sitcoms were supposed to be. So when they became this kind of trading of Harvard-written writerly lines and, you know, cuteness, I stopped being interested. That's just personal.
The thing is, you know, you're talking about these working class type of sitcoms that you really related to, and not relating to the more, you know, middle class or upper middle class ones. Though Cheers was officially working class,
officially,
yeah. But you know, your character Louis is on the sitcom is a part time mechanic. Your parents met at Harvard, from what I read. So, if they met at Harvard and were going to school there,
Well, my mother was from Michigan, and she went to school in Michigan, but she went to Harvard for her summer school 1 year, and that's where she met my dad, who was a Mexican migrant student, I guess you'd call it. He was going to take some grad school classes there. They're not like the two well-raised rich people that went to Harvard. My mother sort of saved and bought herself some classes at Harvard, and my dad came up to try to finish his schooling there. My dad is, I mean, when I was growing up, he was still trying to pursue a degree, I think, and my mom raised us. She taught school part-time, and she worked as a computer programmer, which she still does today. Mm-hmm. And so she really supported us. And actually, my parents were divorced when I was about 10 years old. So I was really raised by my mom, a single mom with four kids in a half of a house. We had rented the lower half of a two-family house, cramped little place. And so we didn't have anything. When I was growing up, we had no money. And a memory that my sisters and I always laugh about is saying to my mother, Mom, I'm hungry. And she'd say, well, make yourself a bologna sandwich. And I'd go, well, I don't like bologna. And she'd say, well, then you're not that hungry. So that's how we were raised. And notice that I'm making myself the bologna sandwich. My mother never made us any. We had a microwave, which meant we made our own meals. And it was just that we fended for ourselves. She worked all day. She had a huge amount of work to do raising us. So everyone had to sort of pitch in. And so I watched her go through a lot of times where there wasn't a lot. And she educated herself. She went and got herself a computer experience and started to do that.
But when you were getting raised by your mother, and she had four kids and worked all the time, were you sympathetic to that? Were you like angry with her because she wasn't like cooking your dinner, or were you sympathetic helpful to the fact, you know, to her because you saw that how difficult it was for her?
I did, absolutely, and I always thought of that. She never made us feel guilty or anything, but I always felt like we all felt like we were in the effort together. We'd all go shopping together, you know, and My mother, she was very kind. So, like, if you got to go shopping with her, it was great because she would always just she'd get a bag of cookies and open them while we shopped. We'd eat them while we shopped. And, so I liked her. I liked my mom. She's nice. So, yes, I did sympathize with her. And actually, I didn't go to college because she had three girls in college when I graduated high school. And she was really struggling mightily because Ronald Reagan was president and he didn't care what you were coping with. You just had to pay on your own. So when I graduated high school, I was such a lousy student that I thought I can't just go, like some of my friends that had more money were just going to college just to go drink and just because that's what you do next. But I really couldn't see doing that because I knew she couldn't really afford it. So I just passed and didn't go continue school because I didn't want to cost her the money. I guess that was the one thing I did that was the most sympathetic.
One of the things that your character is dealing with in your show Lucky Louie is, he's trying to make friends with his neighbors next door. They're an African-American couple. He wants to be their friends. He's also very self-conscious of the fact that they're black and he's white. Mm-hmm. So in wanting to do the right thing, he often does the wrong thing. Can you talk a little bit about trying to write that relationship and what issues you're trying to raise there?
Well, that comes out of a lot of reality in my life because it's just my generation was segregated from black people. And I grew up near Boston, which is a very segregated city. There was zero black people lived where I lived. And they were in our school. And I used to just awkwardly sit at their table because I wanted to know them. And eventually I did make friends with a lot of them, but it had to be done awkwardly. The races are still segregated amazingly, and the only way to actually come across and make a contact is to do it self-consciously, kind of racistly, because you're really saying I want to know you because you're black. There's just no other way to do it, and it is important to me that my daughter know black people. I want her to know everybody. I don't want her to have this, so I have to make this dumb effort. So that story became really important, and actually the part that I tell in the pilot is a true story that a black
fellow... Describe the story, yeah.
We were living actually in upstate New York at the time, and a black guy, there's nobody black where we were up there. A black guy came and fixed our refrigerator, and my daughter really bonded with him over the course of a day. She was like two, and when kids are that age, knowing somebody for a day, it's like she's known him forever, She just really liked the guy, and she would say, refrigerator, and he'd say, yeah, refrigerator, refrigerator. And then we came to New York City, and we were on the subway. And she pointed at the first black guy she saw and said, refrigerator. And I was so shocked and horrified. And I thought, oh, my God, I have to get this little girl around some black people. This is not cool. So it's weird. Because of the segregation, you have to make these awkward, unnatural efforts.
You're a father of two kids?
I have two kids, yeah.
Has it been hard for you to be the authority figure and set limits for your children? Because it seems to me that when you were young, you were probably the kind of kid who was always violating those limits and defying the authority figures in your life.
Yes, I don't know how you picked up on that, but that's true. No, it is weird to be saying, how don't you do this, because I identify with anybody who does something they shouldn't be doing. So including my daughters. And, part of you wants them to build that strength, too. Like, part of you, when your daughter's screaming at you because she doesn't want to put on her shoes or whatever crazy thing, you want to, throw her in a garbage bin. But at the same time, you're proud of her and you're happy that she's building the strength and the skill to stand up for herself, it's just there's so much drama in just trying to do the simplest thing with your kid. Every time I try to discipline my kid, my wife would undercut. Like, I would be locked in a battle of wills with my daughter. Here's the point it got to. I was giving my daughter a bath, and I said, it's time to brush your teeth. And she said, no. She just refused to brush her teeth. And I said, okay, if you don't brush your teeth, then no books tonight. You're not going to get any books. And she said, yes, books, and no brush my teeth. She's like a monkey, that just learned to talk. And I'm like, no brushing teeth, no books. It's that simple. Yes, books, no brushing teeth. And so, and then she said, you brush my teeth. This is how it goes. See, it's like really tricky. You brush my teeth. And I'm thinking, is that compromise? Am I giving in? by brushing her teeth. And I just made a quick judgment and said, no, you brush your teeth or no books. And then my wife said, from the other room, my wife was listening, and my wife said, can you please come in here for a minute? And I go, no, I can't. And then my daughter said, yes, go talk to mama. Go talk to mama right now. Because she knew what's going to happen. So I go in the other room, and my wife says, it's not a good idea to use books as a weapon. They're important to her. And also, I brush her teeth sometimes for her, and you should do that. And I go, no, that's not the point. The point is, I'm right no matter what. You have to go with me. You can't do this to me. And so I go in the other room, and she says, what did mama say? Like that. And I'm like, nothing. She didn't say anything. No, yes, she said that I don't have to. She said I don't have to. Like, she knew it.
Louis C.K. speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His current TV stand-up special, Louis C.K. Chewed Up, is available on Showtime On Demand, and it'll be released in December on CD and DVD. He's currently on tour with an all-new routine called Hilarious. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Rafael Sadiq's first success came in the late 80s as part of the pop soul group Tony Tony Tony. Since that time, he's worked as a producer for such diverse acts as Joss Stone, The Roots, and Snoop Dogg, and has put out two solo albums. His new one, called The Way I See It, is Sadiq's homage to earlier eras of rhythm and blues. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's that and something more.
It's not a stunt, it's not a wallow in nostalgia. Rafael Sadiq's new album, The Way I See It, is the way he hears it. His deep soul grooves have been part of his music for a 20-year career. Over that time, these rhythms have been plastered with different labels. Neo-soul, and remember New Jack Swing? In recent years, there have been a number of artists trying to recapture the sounds of Motown, Stax, and Philadelphia International R&B. But the results have been predictably banal. You can reproduce variations on melodies and rhythm, but without an emotional commitment, it's all tedious pandering to baby boomers. For Rafael Sadiq, there's a glowing vibrancy in soul music that allows him to work out themes and ideas.
Do you mean what you say when you say that you love me? With all honesty, I think I love you. It's every day I think about how special we could be. And how your love is everything to me. In my mind I can see no one but you. Like in my dreams I know I'm holding you. So now tell me the truth, 'cause I need to know. See, I wanna take control, but you gotta let me know. Don't hold me, baby. Show up your mean.
As far back as his work with Tony, 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 Rafael Sadiq has been a singer of doubt, of psychic wounds, of romance undergoing a test. On that song, Sadiq is waiting for a positive sign from the object of his affection. No blustering love man, he croons, I want to take control, but you've got to let me know. This could have been the confession of a wimp, but that's where the authoritative snap of Sadiq's music gives him a bracing strength. He's in this for the long haul or a fast burst, like this one called 100 Yard Dash.
Baby, oh so bad, but I'm running scared, my heart beating so fast. I heard that you
first thing I thought when I heard that song was, what a great propulsive melody it has, and how achy-breaky Sadiq's voice is. It was only afterward that I then thought, and oh yeah, it's also a brilliant take on Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Like many first-rate soul songwriters, Sadiq takes an unorthodox metaphor, love as a fast race that can make a man's heart burst, and he earns it by the variations he sustains verbally, increasing the tension in the song. By the time we reach the end of a 100-yard dash, all he has to do is groan, oh, oh, and you know you've heard a very good song reaching a great peak. Oh, oh, I need to love it. I want to love it. Sadiq fills out his album with a few guest stars. Stevie Wonder, Joss Stone, and Jay-Z bow in to provide some more emphasis and punctuation. But they're not really needed. The sheer joy with which he summons up the Four Tops or the Temptations in a song like this. When I met you, we had a child. I'm so good now. When you kiss me, I couldn't plan this. And that's why I'm so grateful. I feel the sunshine. Invoking 40-year-old genres like that is rendered up to the minute with the timeless message of the chorus, quote, falling in love can be easy, staying in love is too tricky. Too tricky, he says, almost as though the effort isn't worth it. But like all excellent soul men, Rafael Sadiq knows that the illusion of agony is what renders so much music of this kind so pleasurable.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Way I See It by Rafael Sadiq. The third season of the Sarah Silverman program began this week on Comedy Central. It's a sitcom that likes to define topics which, even in these more permissive days of comedy, are considered fairly taboo, and then to tackle them head on. AIDS, abortion, sexual predators, religion, the physically or mentally challenged, it's all fair game for satire. And sometimes that game can make for some intentionally uncomfortable comedy. Sarah Silverman recently won two Emmys for her video short, the title of which includes the name Matt Damon and a verb I can't say on the radio. She has a recurring role as an obsessed neighbor on the TV series Monk and has provided voices for characters on Robot Chicken, Futurama, and Crank Yankers. Terry Gross spoke to Sarah Silverman in 2007 during the second season of the Sarah Silverman program.
Let's hear a clip from an episode from last season called Not Without My Daughter, in which it's a kiddie beauty pageant episode, and there's this Little Miss Rainbow pageant, and you always wanted to win it. So even now as an adult, you're still auditioning for it, even though you're totally much too old for it. And right before you're disqualified, you're doing your dramatic monologue on stage, hoping to become Little Miss Rainbow. Let's hear it.
November 9th, 1942. Peter found some crackers. Mama says we mustn't chew too loud or the Germans may hear. To think we were once Germans ourselves. Well, Hitler's taken our nationality. And he's taken our humanity. But he's not gonna take our rhythm.
Sarah, stop. Please stop.
Sarah Silverman, did you write this monologue?
It's basically from the diary of Anne Frank.
Wait a minute. Anne Frank didn't say, but Hitler couldn't take away our rhythm. That's not from the diary of Anne Frank.
Let's say it's inspired from the diary of Anne Frank, and we used a little poetic license with it, creative license, because then it goes into, of course, a tap routine.
Right. Why did you think that this would... What gave you the idea of borrowing from the diary of Anne Frank for this audition piece for the pageant?
We wanted something that was inappropriate, you know, and did not go well with a tap routine.
Well, I guess that was it.
Yeah, that presented itself and was kind of the perfect choice, the least tasteful choice.
I think most of the episodes end with your character in bed, and before she goes to sleep, she reflects on the day and what she's learned, her lessons learned, and she talks to her dog, Doug, about you know, what's happened to her that day. So I want to play an example of that. And this is at the end of an episode in which you've tried and failed to become a lesbian. And you're talking to your dog, Doug, about it.
I don't know where to start with this one, Doug. I mean, I've failed at heterosexuality. I've failed at homosexuality. I guess I just have to stop thinking that the right person's just going to come along, you know? I have to be the right person. I have to come along. I'm a memosexual. Yeah. Anyway, good night, Dougie. I hope you die in your sleep tonight. Nah, I'm just kidding. But if it had to be one of us, I hope it's you.
That's a scene from the Sarah Silverman program. Sarah, how did you come up with the idea of talking to your little dog, Doug, at the end of each show?
When we first conceived of the show, we thought it would be one full day that starts when I wake up and ends when I go to sleep. And most of the episodes are that, but we didn't. We decided not to like marry ourselves to that because we didn't want to sacrifice a good story or something to some rule, you know, of the show that didn't make it better or worse or anything. It was just kind of a convention that we thought was interesting. So we do. Almost always end with going to bed with Doug and figuring out what we learned. And, of course, what I learned is never very morally valuable. And it just seemed like a good way to kind of bookend the show and to make it all one complete piece. And it was also, you know, we use my real dog.
Oh, I was wondering about that. Really?
Yeah, that's my dog, and his name is actually Duck, D-U-C-K, but in the show it's Doug, which was just a complete whim that I just thought it was funny that we all had our own names, but, you know, Duck is Doug to protect his anonymity. Made me giggle, but now I'm constantly explaining, and people who have known Duck forever is like, is it Duck or Doug? And then I have to be like, no, all right. So, but it's because it's just my dog. He's not some specially trained dog or anything. We try to make it pretty easy for him. So the good nights are perfect. He just lies in bed like he does with me anyway at night. And we shoot him for a second while I talk to him and go, hey, puppy, look over here, you know, and have some good cutaways. And the second episode this season, actually, he's got the A story. So, it was a really fun episode, but I don't think I would want him that heavy in a show again because I really felt like a real scummy showbiz mom or something. Like, you know, just get through this and I'll give you a treat, you know. He's just like, I want to go home.
Your dog is so cute at the end of the show. He sometimes puts his head on your leg, and it's just adorable, and you're telling him all this ridiculous
He just kills
all this ridiculous
me.
Stuff.
Something about his face that looks like he's hearing what you're saying and yet is simultaneously kind of dead inside, which is, I find, compelling and sad.
One of the things you've been doing lately is hosting award shows. You hosted, like, the Video Music Awards on MTV or VH1, I forget which one it's on. You hosted the Independent Spirit of Awards, the Independent Film Awards on the Independent Film Channel. And you're really hysterical. You're hilarious when you do the award shows, but you sometimes say things that really get you into trouble. Like on the Music Video Awards, you said something about Paris Hilton, and she was in the audience, and the camera was a close up on her face as you were talking about her. She looked quite pained. Did you know that the camera was going to be on her?
I didn't. But I'll tell you, I don't think that Paris was upset by my joke. I think what was upsetting, which made my heart sink for her personally, was when I set up the joke and said, you know, Paris Hilton is going to jail in 2 days, the crowd cheered for a minute. You know, like, it was just like a solid minute of cheering. And I felt bad for her at that point because I was looking right down at her and there's a 50-year-old, you know, cameraman in her face. And my heart sank for her because I just thought, wow, this is her example of adults. You know, this is her, like, these are her role models. But I went on with the joke because it's a joke. you know, and I was there to be funny and to talk about all the topics and all the things that were going on in pop culture in the MTV world. And with the VMAs, with this Britney stuff, I did a couple jokes about Britney because I followed Britney. I was put on immediately after her. And then I went on and did a whole bunch of jokes, and they were completely overshadowed by the entree into the monologue, which was, you know, how about that? There was Britney Spears, you know, and a couple jokes about that. I don't think that I said anything different than any late night talk show host has before and after that, but I was first, you know, and I kind of got scapegoated. Surprise, surprise. The Jew is the scapegoat. God forbid she rehearse or whatever. Not stay out till 7 a.m., but I'm the bad guy. It's, you know.
You're one of those people who's managed to kind of create a career on your own terms, you know, by doing, like, stand-up and then doing your own very unusual movie and having your own really eccentric TV show. It's because it's not like other people were writing roles that would have suited you, or not that they were giving them to you.
Yeah, no. I've been really lucky. I mean, the ability to write and to generate and to kind of be the creator of what you do, you know, is such a benefit. You know, if I were just a straight actress, I'd be screwed, you know, because I've been in movies, and I'm pretty much am cast as the bitchy girlfriend before the guy finds out what love can be, or the the sassy or bitchy or what, or roommatey friend, like, as if that's not really an adjective, but. You know, I had a realization, and after this last season of my show, and I don't know how long my show will last or if it's, you know, not long for this world or whatever, but this is what I love to do. I'd still like to be in a movie, sure, but I don't have that need anymore. I would much rather be in my show that I love or do stand-up than play the friend. I have no use for it anymore. It doesn't do anything for me spiritually or career-wise. Or, you know, I got a script sent to me from one of my agents, and it said, you know, on the cover letter, like, so-and-so is set to play the role of Rebecca. Please look at the part of Suze. And I just laughed because I just thought, I don't want to be Suze anymore. I just have no desire to play Suze. You know what I mean? Like, the quintessential friend that is written in lieu of good writing. You know, it's the part is solely to be the exposition of the main girl character, you know? And a good writer will write that in the actions and the dialogue of the main character. But to have a best friend part solely to be the exposition of the main character, it just doesn't do anything for me. It's killing my soul. I don't want to be Suze anymore.
How do your sister is your co-star in the Sarah Silverman program, but yes. how does your extended family feel about it? Because your character is so inappropriate all the time. Are they on the wavelength to kind of get it, or do you have friends or family who are kind of embarrassed about the whole thing?
No, they love it, and they're completely supportive. And it's funny because I know I'm talking about this character I play like she's this completely different entity, and I know that she's probably I'm probably a lot more like her than I'd want to admit to myself, but I have to somehow, because it's funny. I don't know if I told you this last time I was here, but there's a book called Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Walker, or Alice Miller, rather. Alice Miller, sorry. And I was reading this book that Laura had given me, my sister, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. You know, it's all about me, and, you know, and I related to it so much. And I was talking about it to my other sister, Jodine, and her friend, Kathleen, and I said, oh, this book is amazing. Have you read Drama of the Gifted Child? And Kathleen said, oh, by Alice Miller. And I said, yes, yes. And she said, you know, it's a funny story that Alice Miller originally titled that book Drama of the Narcissistic Child. But she knew that no one who needed to read it would buy it.
That's really funny.
And, yeah, that was very funny and a little bit embarrassing.
Sarah Silverman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh. Did we do it?
Yes.
Whew. That was fun.
Yes, it was.
Sarah Silverman, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. The third season of the Sarah Silverman program began this week on Comedy Central. In Ridley Scott's new thriller, Body of Lies, Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe operate in the shadowy world of spies and deceit in the age of terrorism. DiCaprio plays a Mideast CIA agent on the ground, and Crowe plays his boss back at Langley. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Body of Lies is a so-so thriller, but it's fascinating as the first American war on terror movie to weave its anti-U.S. politics so deeply into the narrative that the characters don't need to make big speeches. The politics are snuck in under the cliffhangers. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Roger Ferris, an idealistic Mideast CIA operative constantly undermined by his chummy, Langley-based boss, Ed, played by Russell Crowe with 20 or so extra pounds. Ed doesn't intentionally screw up Ferris's mission. He's also committed to wiping Al-Qaeda off the map. It's just that he's arrogant. When Ferris forms an alliance with the head of Jordanian intelligence, Hani Salam, to do surveillance on a terrorist safe house, Ed plays his own spy games on the side, out of habit. The situation is so abstract for him, he can kiss his kids goodbye at a Virginia school while talking tactics to Roger, whom he always calls Buddy, on his headset.
Listen, you want me to run Amman? Let me run Amman, all right? I have made promises to Hani Salam. You understand that?
Uh-huh. What's your point?
We have to respect what he wants.
I do respect him. What kind of thing?
You were going to blow this entire Amman operation.
I'm just trying to back you up, buddy. It's a dangerous, dangerous world out there, you know?
Well, don't back me up, because I don't need it, all right?
All right, whatever. You ready to go?
Whatever.
Whatever is right. To Ed, everyone is expendable. Frightened informants, contract employees, agents. He's not evil. He's not good. He's meant to embody American callousness and American incompetence, too, because even though he understands intellectually that Al-Qaeda has shunned technology and is playing a ground game, he's not on the ground where it matters. Body of Lies turns on an emerging terrorist leader called Al-Salim and Ferris's plot to smoke him out by creating a fictional terrorist, the idea being that Al-Salim's ego will be threatened by a rival. It's a good gimmick, and well orchestrated in the novel by Washington Post journalist David Ignatius, who knows the territory. But the movie's script, by William Monahan, is ungainly, and director Ridley Scott lets nothing interfere with his lickety-split pacing, including the need to slow down and hit some basic narrative beats. The moment Ferris hatches his scheme is missing. The moment he realizes how he's been used is murky. The payoff is muted. The movie is intense, with a harrowing climax, but it's not witty or memorable. If you've seen Joel and Ethan Coen's Burn After Reading, you might giggle at genre tropes the brothers burlesqued, here played absolutely straight. DiCaprio is fine, as usual, but the role has no color. The casting of Crowe is a bit of a stunt, one of the most physically intense actors alive, as a man so removed from the consequences of his actions, from the real world, that he doesn't even seem connected to his body. Because he's a star, we watch him attentively, but Ed remains a caricature. What keeps Body of Lies from being a non-event is a turn by the British actor Mark Strong as Jordanian spymaster Hani. He looks a little like Andy Garcia. He's sleek, darkly handsome, immaculately dressed, his posture relaxed, yet somehow coiled. His words to DiCaprio's Ferris are measured, yet momentous.
Now, we've recently discovered a large Al-Salim safe house and training cell here in Amman. I would need your help with surveillance, sir. Now, this is what we know so far.
Is this unusual? Your Ed Hoffman would rather have less information than share what he has with me.
Well, this is not Ed Hoffman. This is not my predecessor. This is me, sir. Please have a look.
I have one rule. If we are to cooperate, my dear, never lie to me. Understand? Never lie to me.
It's fitting the actor playing the Jordanian should walk away with the movie, because the thrust of Body of Lies is that his character has far more understanding of how things work than the Americans do, a bitter assessment of U.S. chances in the war on terror. The movie is one of a new breed of thrillers that reflects a new national mood, a rejoinder to the myth of American omniscience. It says, we don't know nothing.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.